Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, a new revelation into the BP oil spill, the use of nanotubes to target radiotherapy, the cost to the environment of us cruising through the air, and how comets helped stimulate life on Earth. We also discover how the field of click chemistry is transforming stem cell research, as well as the latest developments in the search for blood substitutes and the benefits these could provide.
Because it's long-lasting, you could leave it in, it could be in an ambulance on the top of a mountain in Afghanistan, it could be where a remote doctor is in Australia, it could be in the African bush. So you have this ability to be able to go anywhere with the product, keep it off-site, or stockpile it for emergencies.
Essex University's Chris Cooper will be explaining the challenges faced when developing these substitutes and how his team are trying to overcome them. So all that coming up in this October edition of Chemistry World with me, Meera Senthilingam, and contributors this month, Phil Broadwith, Andrew Turley and Anna Lucock.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First up this month, more revelations into the cause of the BP oil spill. Phil?
Okay, so BP has put out a report saying that there were eight things that specifically went wrong that contributed to the massive oil spill and explosion that happened in the Gulf of Mexico earlier this year. And one of those, in fact the first one that they identified, was to do with the cement. The cement job that they were trying to do is part of the standard procedure for finishing off drilling a well. You have to seal the bottom with cement so that you have a stable hole drilled in the earth and then you can start pumping the oil up. But to do that, you have to get the cement down there to the bottom, which can take quite a while if it's a deep well. So you have to have cement that is fluid enough to get down there and will then cure properly at the high temperatures and pressures that are down there in the bottom of the well.
So what was actually found then to be wrong with the cement as it had gone down, and who's been looking into this?
The way that they were trying to make the cement fluid enough and get it to flow down the well was by making a sort of foam with nitrogen gas. That makes the cement lighter and it also makes it more fluid so they can pump it down, spread it out around the bottom of the well where it needs to be, and then as long as the foam stays as a foam, everything's fine. But what they found was the foam's likely to collapse under the conditions at the bottom of the well, which means you get this thing called nitrogen breakout. Nitrogen breakout is bubbles forming in the cement which make channels through the cement as it's drying, which means that you then have holes and a porous structure that the oil and gas can seep through and then escape up to the top of the well.
So is this breakout what's thought to have happened then?
That's what BP is saying. The picture gets a little bit less clear when you consider that the cement that they've done these tests on is not the actual cement that went down the well. So it's quite possible that there were different additives in it and all things like that. And it's not just about the cement chemistry either. You've got to get the cement in the right place, which involves the whole engineering project of how you do the job. And there's all sorts of other bits and bobs you need to get right so that the cement spreads out around the bottom of the well in a sort of even way to make a good plug.
So now that the importance of, say, the cement has been found out, is this then going to be useful perhaps just in other oil rigs?
Well, something that BP's identified in its report is that there might have been some problems with the cement. So it's something that people are obviously going to have to look at a little bit more closely each time. Something that came out was that this process of using nitrogen to make the cement fluid, the conditions that were in the Deepwater Horizon well were right on the limit of what's been done before with this kind of technique. So it was possibly a little bit risky anyway. Maybe we need to look at some different things to add to the cement rather than nitrogen that won't cause this breakout kind of thing.
Okay, so well, avoiding anything like that in the future is obviously crucial. But now moving on from that environmental concern to another one, and that is aircraft emissions. Andrew?
So this story is about aircraft emissions, but not carbon dioxide, which we've obviously heard a great deal about in recent years. This is about particulates, small bits of dust and grime that come out as traditional sort of pollution. What these researchers have found is that 80% of the total health impact from aircraft emissions at ground level is coming from the cruise phase. So this is the main flying segment of the plane. Whereas in the past, scientists have focused on the takeoff and landing.
And so how has this insight come about? So who's been looking into it, and how big a concern really are the emissions then during cruising?
Well, the researchers are from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the US, and they've been modelling this to work these things out. One of the most unfair aspects of this is that even though much of the flight patterns, much of the air traffic originates outside of Asia, the burden of these health effects lands in Asia.
But what's actually causing the problem then in these emissions?
The problem is aerosols. So these are droplets of liquids, in this case nitric acid and sulfuric acid, and these are damaging to people's health.
And what makes them particularly damaging, say, in the region of Asia? Why that particular continent?
Well, it's farming is exacerbating the problem in that region, because the nitric acid can react with the high concentrations of ammonia, mainly from farming, and this can form ammonium nitrate.
What can be done knowing this information? Should governments be taking this on board, or what's hoped to happen?
Well, it's really just another reason for us to reduce our air traffic generally. And something I've heard from atmospheric chemists in the past is that while a lot of the attention has been focused on climate change and carbon dioxide emissions, we really should be thinking of this more holistically, alongside pollution at ground level from particulates.
So there's more to flying than just takeoff and landing. Thanks, Andrew. Now, you may have come across the recent wave of vampire-related fiction in our books and on our screens, where these blood-sucking characters are living in harmony with their human counterparts, thanks to things like synthetic blood. But in the real world, this is an area scientists haven't quite reached and have been working on for a long time. Well, not feeding vampires, but developing artificial blood substitutes to provide a more comfortable and accessible bank of blood to call on. And it's all quite complicated, as Chris Cooper from the University of Essex explained.
Right, there are two different classes of blood substitute. I would call one chemical blood and one biological blood. The chemical blood just consists of molecules that can dissolve oxygen very effectively. These are molecules that are called perfluorocarbons. They're very inert, they're very unreactive with anything, and they just dissolve lots of oxygen. And in fact, a molecule of that class was the first one that was officially allowed to be used as a blood substitute in the US, so it's no longer used. There's still a version of that that is on use in a very few parts of Russia, but it's not used in a widespread way. So that's the chemical blood. The alternative, which has had much more interest and many more products attempted to be developed, is what we call biological blood. And that takes the red part of red blood cells, the hemoglobin, and what it does is try to make it active and still able to carry oxygen outside the red blood cell. And most products have gone down that route, and most of the research is in that area, but it's not exclusive.
And I guess the problem, really, then, one of the main obstacles is actually hemoglobin in these substitutes. Is that right?
Yes, it's both the greatest benefit and the greatest boon, the hemoglobin. So it's a wonderful molecule because it can carry oxygen around the body really, really effectively. But it can also do other chemistry. So unlike a fluorocarbon, which is a completely inert chemical, the hemoglobin, which does the job of carrying oxygen much better, is chemically reactive, and that's the problem.
So how are you setting about kind of researching this area now? So what do you focus on in order to develop hopefully useful artificial blood?
Well, there are two chemical problems, if you like, with the hemoglobin, neither of which we think relate to its normal function of oxygen transport. It gets rid of your good radicals, and it makes bad radicals. So it all relates to free radical biology. And obviously free radicals, as any chemist knows, are reactive species. What hemoglobin can do is it binds nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is a signaling molecule, a gas in the body, that controls blood flow and blood pressure and a whole range of other physiological parameters. Hemoglobin can scavenge that nitric oxide. That's potentially a problem, and it can cause blood pressure changes and blood flow changes. That's one problem, the removing the good radical. The second problem is that hemoglobin also can create oxygen-based radicals by reacting with hydrogen peroxide or lipid peroxides that are always in the body. And it's especially likely to do that when it's outside the protective environment of the red blood cell. What we're doing at Essex is trying to alter the hemoglobin so that it doesn't do the second part of that chemistry, the oxygen radical part. We're not doing the nitric oxide part as yet.
And so given with your actual product, how does this actually work then to actually function as blood?
So what we've discovered is that there are pathways in the hemoglobin molecule that are responsible for these free radicals being removed, so these dangerous free radicals. And the body does have compounds it uses to remove the free radicals. And one of these is vitamin C, the ascorbate, which you've got in your blood, in your plasma. So we put a blood substitute into the plasma, and the ascorbate is one of the key ways of detoxifying these radicals. And what we've done is genetically engineer the hemoglobin molecule to create new biological pathways to make it easier for the ascorbate to get rid of the free radicals. So it's, if you like, enhancing the body's own defence mechanisms.
Where are you currently with this work? How far away do you think we are then from this more kind of biological form of artificial blood?
So if you're asking about how far we are at Essex, we're still really in the studying the effect on the cells and trying to optimise our lead compound, if you like. If you ask about how far the world is, there is still a compound going through clinical trials made by a company called Sangard. We don't know yet whether it will work or not, and it's going through a quite complicated clinical trial in trauma patients at the moment. So I always answer that question really by saying there could be a clinical product in 2 years or 10 years.
And I guess a big question is always cost as well. So how expensive will these products be when they are actually on the market, or is that just not known yet really?
I think it's not known because of the scale of how you make them. I mean, the thing about making blood products is that you're making them sort of pharmaceutical at an amount that nobody has tried before. But the idea would be to be competitive with blood. And of course, blood is not free, because although it's wonderful that people give their blood free, at least in the UK, all the testing and the packaging of it costs money, so that blood costs about £200 a unit in the UK. So you'd obviously want to be able to make a unit of artificial blood competitive with a unit of real blood.
And if this were to become available, how useful, how advantageous do you think it will be just in relation to donated blood?
Well, let's say you had artificial blood that was completely equivalent to blood in terms of its normal use. The advantages you would have with artificial blood was it would be much more long-lasting. So normal blood you have to get rid of in 42 days. One of the products lasts a year already. That's been in clinical trials. So you can, it's long-lasting, and therefore some of the problems with having to get rid of all your blood within the 42 days and having to throw some away would not be there. Because it's long-lasting, you could leave it in places like it could be in an ambulance on the top of a mountain in Afghanistan, it could be where a remote doctor is in Australia, it could be in the African bush. So you have this ability to be able to go anywhere with the product, keep it off-site, or stockpile it for emergencies. So that's a major issue. There's a very small problem with blood that it's mistyped, and that's always a very small human error. But because so much blood is used, you do occasionally get those mismatches. That shouldn't be a problem with this product. I'd say that's a rather minor benefit. But certainly the fact that you could have a generic blood you could give anywhere and could be long-lasting is important. And I just make one other point. Although our blood is safe at the moment, it's not tested for every virus. Now, the ones it's not tested for are not really a problem at the moment. If a new HIV came up, there are a lot of people, unfortunately, who caught AIDS from blood transfusions. You would remove that possibility forever if you had an artificial blood.
So plenty of important advantages there, reducing risk and increasing accessibility and storage options. That was Chris Cooper, Professor of Biochemistry at the University of Essex. This is Chemistry World with me, Miracynthi Lingam. And still to come, we investigate a relatively new field of chemistry that's transforming the field of tissue and organ regeneration. But first, Anna, a sticky insight into the world of oysters.
Yes, so Jonathan Wilker and his team at Purdue University in the US and colleagues at the University of South Carolina have managed to identify the added ingredient that distinguishes oyster glue from the glue of other marine species like barnacles or mussels.
So what have they found? What is it that distinguishes it?
Oysters build these enormous reefs that are made of billions of oysters that they stick to one another, and they build these massive sort of shellfish walls that are tens of metres deep and several square kilometres in area. So they're really huge constructions. But there's not much that's actually been known about how they do it and what that glue that holds it all together is made of. So the team used a range of spectroscopy and analysis techniques to look at the glue, and they compared it to that of mussels and barnacles to see if there was any difference. The glues of mussels and barnacles are mainly protein, and they found some cross-linked proteins in the oyster glue, so there were some similarities there, but that's about where the similarities ended. Barnacle glue, for example, has about 10 times the water content of oyster glue, but the biggest difference that they found between the oyster glue and the glues of other shellfish marine species was that the oyster glue contains a very high proportion of inorganic material like calcium carbonate. And it's this inorganic-organic hybrid that makes up the oyster cement and makes it different from that of other marine shellfish species.
But why does this increase, say, in inorganic components make it a better adhesive?
The kind of difference between it is that the glues that are in barnacles or mussels, for example, are kind of a soft, possibly more liquidy glue, whereas the low water content and high inorganic content in the oyster glue makes it more of a cement and therefore probably a stronger adhesive.
And so what kind of things could this be used in then?
Well, there's several aspects to this, really. Those massive reefs that I referred to earlier, they actually form quite an important habitat and ecosystem for other species, and they've actually been destroyed quite a lot. Some areas, the oyster population has been reduced by over 90% because of pollution, overfishing, that kind of thing. So it's hoped that a bit more insight into things like the oyster cement will help them reintroduce oysters back into those habitats. And the other thing is so that you'll be able to form synthetic versions of these adhesives that could be useful perhaps in medical implants and that kind of thing. But also the insight into how the cement works means that they also might be able to develop coatings, for example, for the bottom of ships that would stop these oysters sticking in the first place. So the added insight might be able to be used to protect vessels as well.
And the use of this as a protectant then would actually have benefits compared to what's currently used as well?
Absolutely. At the moment, a lot of the anti-fouling materials are based on copper, for example, which isn't too good for the environment when it starts leaching out of the paints and things that are used on the bottom of ships at the moment.
OK, well, thank you, Anna. And now moving over to some potential biological applications, there's been recent work in the use of nanotubes in the fight against cancer.
Yes, Mira. There's been a lot of people talking for a long time about using nanotubes to deliver drugs. And this is one of the first actual examples of somebody putting a therapeutic agent inside a nanotube and delivering it to a specific area of the body. It's been done by Ben Davis from the University of Oxford. And what his group have done is work with Malcolm Green, who's also at Oxford, who recently developed a way of filling carbon nanotubes with stuff. So the stuff in this case is sodium iodide. If you use a radioactive isotope of iodine in your sodium iodide and seal it inside the carbon nanotube, you've then got a kind of little deliverable radiation pill almost that you can take to whatever area in the body that you like.
But say with this isotope in the nanotube, how would it actually be released, and how would it be released in the right place as well?
OK, well, that's the beauty of it, Mira. You don't have to release the sodium iodide. In fact, you don't want to. So these nanotubes are quite slightly different from normal nanotubes in that they're completely sealed at both ends with the sodium iodide inside. What you're then delivering is radiation. So the photons of the gamma rays can get out in between the gaps in the molecule of the carbon nanotube. So you're essentially delivering radiation to exactly where you want it. So all you then have to do is find a way of targeting the nanotube. And what Ben Davis's group has done is attach a molecule to the outside that has a particular kind of sugar on it, which binds to a protein that's present in the lungs.
And what is this sugar then, and how does it ensure that the tube gets to the lungs? And also, could you perhaps attach other things as well to get it to different locations?
Well, yes, that's exactly the idea. At the moment, they've got one type of sugar. It's N-acetylglucosamine in particular. Or it's a particular arrangement of N-acetylglucosamine. It binds to one specific protein that happens to be in the lungs. The problem is we don't have a map of all of the sugars that bind to different proteins in different parts of the body or on different tumours. That's kind of the next stage. But you could also think about using antibodies attached to the outside to target the nanotubes as well.
What about risks? Are there any risks associated with this?
Okay, well, there's been quite a lot of talk about the toxicity or not of nanotubes, and we've had several stories about it in Chemistry World, but talking to Professor Davis, he was saying that they've done some toxicity experiments. They don't see any kind of evidence of the nanotubes breaking down in the body, and because they're quite short, these nanotubes, they don't have so many of the toxicity problems like much longer nanotubes acting in the same way as asbestos, for example. So all they see happening to these nanotubes is that they go to the liver and spleen and they're just cleared into out of the bloodstream in the normal kind of excretory system.
And fingers crossed it proves effective. Thanks, Phil. Well, moving on to a reasonably youthful field of chemistry now that's been shown to have applications across many areas of science, and that's click chemistry. One scientist using this on stem cells to further our prospects of tissue and organ regeneration is Cole DeForest from the University of Colorado. He explained more about just what click chemistry is.
Click chemistry basically refers to a chemical philosophy that was introduced by Barry Sharpless of the Scripps Research Institute out of California back in 2001. And so this chemical philosophy really refers to a class of reactions that meet a number of criteria. Some of these criteria include that they proceed very quickly under mild conditions, as well as in a variety of solvents. But perhaps most importantly of all, they proceed extremely selectively, meaning that the presence of other functional groups in these reactions doesn't interfere with the desired reaction. So the most common of the click reactions is the so-called Huygen-1,3 dipolar cycloaddition, which involves the copper-catalyzed addition of an azide to a terminal alkyne. This reaction has really been used in just about every field, from polymer synthesis and modification to drug discovery, DNA modification, and nanotechnology. This reaction really has proven to be the poster child of the so-called click revolution. More recently, another reaction of interest, the so-called silene reaction, has reached this click status. And this silene reaction involves the radical-mediated addition of a thiol across the carbon-carbon double bond. Now, this reaction has a benefit over the Huygen reaction in that it can be initiated and controlled with light, which ultimately enables the reaction to be controlled spatially as well as temporally, giving the user control over where, both in space and time, this reaction will occur. So this reaction has actually been used to selectively pattern substrates, including DNA microarrays and microfluidic devices. But really, those are the two main reactions of the field of click chemistry to date.
So is it fair then to summarize the reactions involved with click chemistry as reactions where you can essentially build up and the addition of chemical groups to each other?
Yes, that's exactly right. So the idea behind click chemistry is that you're clicking multiple moieties together in an extremely controlled and quick and efficient manner.
And so within this area, though, you're using stem cells.
That's correct. Because these click reactions are so selective, we can develop systems where multiple functionalities can be incorporated into the same platform. So in our case, we actually use the first of the click reactions, the Huygen reaction, to form hydrogel materials in the presence of cells, which ultimately trap these cells in a supportive 3D environment. Now, we use hydrogels because they have a high water content and a tissue-like elasticity, which adequately mimic the cell's natural environment. Now, these materials, hydrogels, have actually been used to study in culture cells in 3D for a number of years, and they ultimately form the basis for the field of tissue engineering, which is what we're interested in. But once we form these materials using this first reaction, we can come back and build upon that using the silene reaction, and we can actually come back and decorate our hydrogel network with molecules of interest. So these molecules include growth factors, proteins, peptides, as well as just basic chemical moieties, to be able to detect as well as direct cell behavior in three dimensions. So in the case of stem cells, what we're interested in is being able to use these patterned molecules to actually induce differentiation of cells down different user-defined lineages. So this really opens up the door for starting with an initially homogeneous population of stem cells patterning in molecules that will spatially pattern in areas of differentiation within the cell population in a way that ultimately mimics how the native tissue forms. In a way, this technology ultimately enables us to go about printing three-dimensional organs within our hydrogel material.
So you're largely suspending and keeping stable these stem cells, but then using the other reaction to try and lead or direct the differentiation of these stem cells into the types of cells you'd like them to form.
Yep, that's exactly correct.
So where are you currently with this, though? What's been possible so far? What lines of differentiation have you been able to go down?
So we've mostly been working with human mesenchymal stem cells, and these cells are ultimately what's responsible for differentiation into bone, cartilage, as well as fat cells. So we kind of envision being able to engineer a sort of new knee joint where cells are initially in this hydrogel material, and then we can direct spatially these cells to become both the bone as well as the cartilage interface that ultimately makes up this new knee. So now we're actually in the process of going about verifying that we have successfully pushed these cells down whatever lineages that we're aiming for, and going about trying to just see that the cells that we've induced this behavior in are really behaving the way that we would expect them to in the body as well.
If it's then possible with cartilage, you would then be pursuing all the other different types of cells in our body as well then?
Eventually, yes. We're kind of in an interesting area where we work very closely with a lot of the molecular biologists who are making great discoveries as far as what chemical factors are ultimately responsible for the differentiation of these different stem cells down a variety of lineages. So as they continue to make discoveries about what molecules are important, we can go about engineering them into our materials to direct different cell types down these differentiation paths.
This is really, though, one of the big goals of generally of medicine and human biology at the moment, really, just to be able to, so if somebody needs something repairing, to be able to use stem cells to just generate matching kind of cartilage or matching cells that could just be used in their bodies to repair them, essentially.
Yeah, ideally what we'd like to be able to do is to have a patient to isolate some of their own stem cells to grow them up outside of the body and exponentially increase the number of cells that we're working with, then to encapsulate them into these materials, direct the cells into whatever organ we're interested in, and then to actually implant them back into the body. And with that, by using the patient's own cells, we really try and minimize the risk for organ rejection.
And how far away would you say then we are from this actually being a reality?
I think with simple tissues, we're actually pretty close. Working with bone and cartilage, I wouldn't be surprised if we see that in the next 5 or 10 years. More complex organs and tissues will take a little bit of time, but I certainly think we'll see it in our lifetimes.
Cole DeForest from the University of Colorado. Now, still to come, we've got some chemical trivia for you. But first, a shockwave of a discovery into how life began on Earth. Andrew?
Yes, so this story is about shockwaves from comets hitting the Earth and how these could have helped create life. There's actually two aspects to this story. One is the way in which small molecules could have been brought to the planet, and then how the shockwaves from an impact could have helped stick those molecules together to get larger molecules, which are the key building blocks of life.
So who's been looking into this, and how have they set about seeing the effects of a comet?
So these are US researchers from two institutions, the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and Stanford University, led by Nir Goldman, and they ran a range of theoretical simulations on computers.
You've said that there are two aspects to this story, really. So first of all, how are comets thought to have potentially brought some life to Earth?
So comets are made up of dust, ice and compressed gases. The ice is mostly water, but often there are other small molecules in there containing carbons and nitrogens, which are what you need to get life started. So things like carbon dioxide, ammonia and methanol.
And how could the shockwave then associated with the comet stimulate this further?
Well, as I said, there's two issues to this. One is getting the small molecules to Earth. In the past, people have thought it's very difficult because of the high temperatures and pressures that are generated during entry. This would have damaged the molecules in some way. But by focusing on a gentler angle or investigating entry at a gentler angle, the researchers have shown that it would have been possible to get some of these molecules to the Earth's surface. And then the shockwaves from the comets could have produced temperatures and pressures that would have been conducive to stimulating the development from these small molecules like carbon dioxide and ammonia to amino acids such as glycine.
And so how are they planning to perhaps take this further to verify it, perhaps?
They want to look at these sorts of simulations over longer timescales to see if they can work out more about the next stages of life on Earth. I mean, this is research that doesn't have obvious industrial applications or real-world applications, but there's always been a huge amount of interest in this fundamental scientific question.
OK, well, thank you, Andrew. And now, Anna, moving from comets initiating life to chemistry mimicking life, plant life, that is. Tell me more about this.
We've got a team here from the Max Planck Institute of Colloids and Interfaces in Germany. And what they've done is managed to create a complex, really quite intricate iron carbide microstructure that was based on a leaf template.
So why this material? Why iron carbide?
So metal carbides have some really useful properties like resistance to high temperatures and mechanical stress that have been exploited in lots of applications from hard coatings to medical implants and catalysis. But sort of because of those properties, synthesising those carbide materials can be quite challenging and cumbersome, requiring a lot of steps to get it done. And there's not a lot of research that's been done on controlling the microstructure of those kind of materials.
So how did the researchers set about actually studying it?
Well, the process they used is really quite simple, and that was with one of the plus points of what they've done. They got hold of a leaf skeleton and they soaked it in an iron acetate solution. They dried it at 40 degrees in air and then heated it under nitrogen to 700 degrees. During that process, the leaf decomposes to a carbon-rich matrix and the iron acetate decomposes to iron oxide. The high-temperature reaction that occurs between the materials produces this porous iron carbide leaf replica right down to the microstructure of the individual leaf veins.
So what would potential applications be then of this leaf structure made of these metal carbides?
Well, the leaf that the researchers created was found to be magnetic and conductive, and they used it, for example, in electrodes for water splitting. But rather than an iron carbide leaf being particularly useful or finding any particular applications, the advance was more the success in finding a way to make those really complex, intricate metal carbide structures. Because in theory, it's any carbon-based material or structure that could be used as a template. You just need to pick something with the structural characteristics that you want and hopefully just use the same process.
Thanks, Anna. Right, well, that's nearly it for this month. But before we go, it's time for some chemical trivia. And this month's trivia is, how much does a mole of moles weigh? Well, if you work it out based on the average weight of an adult male mole, it comes to a tenth of the mass of the Earth, which is quite a lot. Now, if that's taken your interest, or in fact has failed to impress you, let us know your chemical trivia by sending it to chemistryworld@rsc.org, and you may just win a Chemistry World goodie bag. But that's definitely it now for this month. We're back with more chemical news and highlights next month. But don't forget, in the meantime, there's also our sister podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, to keep you entertained, which has now started a new series looking into our chemical compounds. Contributors this month were Phil Broadwith, Anna Lucock and Andrew Turley. And until next month, thank you for listening. I'm Mira Senthilingam.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.